Good morning, everybody. We are going to wade into one of the most fascinating parshiot of the Torah today. We're going to wade into Parshas Vayishlach. All right, let's set the scene. Let's remember where we are in the story. Yaakov Avinu ran away from his home, spent years in the house of Laban, and now he is returning. Now he's coming back to spend time back in Eretz Yisrael, in Eretz Canaan, and the first thing he will have to confront is a reunion with his brother Esau. But before we get to that, which we're going to focus on this morning, let's understand that Parshas Vayishlach has a particular character to it, which I think is fascinating. And that is that it is, I would call it an ambivalent Parsha. What I mean by that is, every single event that takes place in Parshas Vayishlach, the Torah sort of leaves open to interpretation as to whether it's good or bad, or what actually occurs. For example, the Torah begins with Yaakov Avinu sending messengers to his brother Esau as he comes back into Eretz Canaan. Right away the rabbis argue, is he doing the right thing? Should he let sleeping dogs lie? Should he simply come back and not confront Esau? Should he come back quietly and let Esau eventually discover that he's there? Or is he doing the right thing? Is he doing the right thing by saying, well, we have an issue here, let's confront it head on, and let's try to deal with it from the start? He then adopts a particular posture in his dealings with Esau. He calls himself Avdecha, he calls himself your servant, Esav, I'm your servant. He bows down 7 times. Again, the rabbis argue, is he doing the right thing? How do you handle someone like Esav? Do you deal with him diplomatically, or do you stand the line? And throughout Jewish history, these kinds of questions will emerge in our dealings with the world around us. Then they meet. The rabbis argue, we'll see this today, is there eventual harmony? Is there not eventual harmony? Is Esau really sincere in his embrace of his brother or not? And it's left for interpretation. It's left open. It's not clear. Torah goes on. The Torah discusses the horrific events that surround the encounter of the children of Israel with Shechem, and the capture and rape of Dinah, and eventually the vengeance that's taken by Shimon and Levi on the city, where they destroy an entire city. And again, the Torah leaves the conclusion very uncertain as to whether they did the right thing or whether they did the wrong thing. Yaakov censures them. Yaakov says, you did the wrong thing, but the only reason he says it is because you made me weak in the eyes of the people around me. And they respond, can someone make our sister a harlot? And that's the end of the conversation. And you don't know who's right, who's wrong. And in fact, later on, Shimon and Levi will be, it seems, cursed by their father, or at least their anger is cursed. Arur Apam, I'm going to spread them out through the children of Israel, and Levi and Shimon are spread out eventually through the territory of Israel. But look how Levi, for example, is spread out. He's spread out by becoming the Levim, right? So it's honorific as opposed to being a punishment. So all of this seems to indicate, the way I view it is, Yaakov Avinu is returning to the real world now. Things were black and white in Laban's house. In Laban's house, you saw what you were dealing with, you knew what you were dealing with, and it was clear. Now you're coming back to the real world, Yaakov. And if you're coming back to the real world, the world is painted in shades of gray. And the answers and the conclusions and the decisions that you will make are going to be very complex. And very often you're not going to know whether you're making the right decision at the point you're making it, and you'll only be able to see it down the road in long terms. And therefore, Vayishlach seems to take this ambivalent approach to the events that occur within it to remind us that the world is gray and that everything is complex. Now, of all the events that occur, perhaps the most mysterious is, of course, the struggle between Yaakov and a mysterious stranger in the darkness of the night on the eve of his meeting with Asaph. And that's what we're going to focus on today. We're going to take a look at that struggle. We're going to try to find out how Chazal view it and how we might view it and what lessons we might learn from it. Take a look at the text before you. And let's just review it quickly. Before we do so, let's remember the specific scene with which this paragraph opens. Yaakov Avinu is preparing, or has prepared, for his meeting with Esav. Messengers have come back and said that your brother is coming to meet you with 400 of his closest friends. All right, now 400 of his closest friends means an army, right? So Yaakov is frightened. Yaakov is frightened, and he prepares according to the Torah, and Chazal point this out, that he prepares in three ways. He sends gifts to appease his brother. He prays to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he prepares for war. And again, this sets an example for how one is supposed to act. You know, one would think, Yaakov, you know, he should simply sit back and say, okay, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, take care of me, right? But that's not how Yaakov works, and nor is it how we're supposed to work. Ein somchin al hanes, you don't rely on miracles. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to take care of you, but only if you take care of yourself. And therefore, Yaakov has done everything possible to prepare for this meeting with Esav. He beds down for the night. And then this paragraph occurs. Let's read it. Vayakom balaylohu, vayikach eshtei noshav, eshtei shivchosav, eshachad asor yeladov, vayavor esmavor yavok. He wakes up in the middle of the night. And in the middle of the night, he takes his wives and his maidservants and his children, and he begins to move. He crosses the Ma'avar Yabok, he crosses the ford of Yabok. Vayikochem vayavirem es hanachal vayaver es asher lo. He crossed them over the Nachal, he crossed them over this ford, this stream, and he crossed everything that was his. Vayivoser Yaakov levado. Yaakov was left alone. Vayeoveg ishimo ad alos hashachar. And a man struggled with him until the dawn. So let's just stop there. We'll go on in a few minutes. What questions do you have? You should have a series of questions on these three sentences.
Was he dreaming?
All right, was he dreaming? Okay, that's an interesting question. According to Rambam, the Rambam will say that every encounter in the Torah with an angel occurs in a vision. All right, so it's not happening. Others will say no. All right, keep going. What else? What are your questions?
Why was he alone?
All right, well, how was he suddenly left alone? How did that happen, right? Keep going.
Who was the man?
Who is this man? All right, now let's understand. The Torah is so abrupt in the introduction of this individual, right? It doesn't say he picks up his eyes, he sees somebody coming, right? That's how it would usually be. He looks, he sees a guy approaching, right? Remember when Avram sees the angels approaching the tent? Simply says, poof, vayavek ishimo. The guy's suddenly there.
And why are they fighting?
And why are they fighting? Correct. All right. You left one question out.
Masi ovo simon the bunny, right?
Right.
Now, why? Why do we have to fall? Why didn't he take a preemptive action to knowing that Esav is coming with armed men?
Why doesn't he just leave? What should he do?
Yeah, he should prepare for a preemptive.
Well, he prepared for defense. He didn't. He can't attack. All right. What?
We have to attack. That's what I mean.
We have to attack. He doesn't have the men to attack. He doesn't have 400 men. Right. So that I hear your question, but that's going to tie into the question that I said nobody asked. What is he doing, waking up in the middle of the night and moving the camp?
One can see him.
Let's remember, he's already done what he thinks he's supposed to do. He's divided the camp, right? He said, if Esav is going to attack, then at least we won't all be killed. I've divided the attack. I see, you're saying he's too passive, but I don't think he's got the men to attack 400 men. So he's defending himself as best he can. But if everything is set and he's done what he's intending to do, why is he suddenly waking up in the middle of the night and moving people? What's going on here? What's happening? He's nervous. What?
All of a sudden it's hitting him.
It's hitting him? Okay, so what's he doing? So let's start with that question, because that's the first question that emerges. And depending on how we understand the answer to this question, it'll affect how we understand everything else in the text. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, maybe because they're crossing a stream of water.
Right.
That he knows that his brother will also have to cross the stream, and maybe he makes some kind of a defense.
Okay, so that suggestion number one is that he wakes up in the middle of the night because he's nervous, as you say, and he begins to act. He says, well, maybe, you know, can you imagine your Yaakov for a second? Maybe if I move here, you know, I moved here, but maybe I'll be safer if I move there, or maybe I'll be safer if I move there. So he's trying to prepare in a better way. That's suggestion number one. What's suggestion number two?
The initial plan may be, let me put half my wives and children in this camp. Half,
right, yeah. I'll split them up.
Then he said, well, what if, God forbid, it really happens that one gets annihilated? I'm going to lose half my family?
All right.
So he decides, well, I'll have one decoy camp that's easier.
A decoy camp. He's keeping that camp there.
The second camp that can flee. Okay. All right.
So you're actually stepping over a line that I'm going to step over in a moment. All right. Right now, but you're still on this side of the line. So far, your answers are that he's preparing, right? Somehow he's doing additional preparations. There's a second approach within Chazal. He's running away. Simple. He wakes up in the middle of the night. He says to himself, hey, no matter what happens here, 400 men, this isn't a peaceful event. I don't have the army with which to fight this. He gets up and he runs. And that is the second possible approach. Second approach is Vayokom Balayla, who he gets up in the middle of the night, he takes his camp, he crosses the Mavar Yavok. He's not doing it to create a decoy, he's not doing it to create another possibility, he's not finding a better place. He says, I'm out of here. Okay? Now that's going to affect which of those two approaches we take. These are both approaches by Chazal. Which of these two approaches we take will affect how we understand everything that happens next. So keep them both in mind. One is, which you seemed all to take, which was he's preparing again. And one is that he's planning to leave. He just says, I'm out of here. This isn't going to end well for me, and I'm going. Okay. That's question number one, two approaches. Let's go on. Vayikochem vayaavirem es hanachal vayaaver es asher lo. He takes them, he crosses the Mavar Yabok, again, either to set up a new strategy or to run. He crosses everything that's his. Vayivoser Yaakov levado, Yaakov is left alone. Okay, so there's your next question. How does Yaakov suddenly find himself alone? So there's what I would call the Pashut Pshat approach, and there's the Medrashic approach here. Let's start with the Pashut Pshat approach. And I thank God I think most of you are in the generation that will understand this. And that is, the Pashut Pshat approach is what I call the John Wayne approach. All right? Did you ever see John Wayne? For those of you who don't know, he's an American movie star, cowboy, right? How does John Wayne cross a river with his camp? All right? John Wayne stands on one side of the river, and he goes, ho! Right? He stands there like this, and everybody's crossing, right? Which means that for one split second, at the end of this entire process, his camp is there, and he's still left alone on the other side. So that's the Pashupshat approach. Pashupshat approach is that he crossed everything over, and before he had a chance to follow, punkt. For a split second, he's left alone. And what is the message of the Torah here? When are we vulnerable? Any one of us? When we're left alone. Right? That, I mean, how you explain this sentence is less important, perhaps, than its message, which is Vayivoser Yaakov Levado, Vayeyoveki Shimo Analoser Shachar. The moment Yaakov finds himself alone, that's the moment he becomes vulnerable to attack. And in fact, the Sfarno, the Italian commentary, says, if you'll remember, at the end of this story, we're going to not, there's a piece of meat, or there's a part of an animal we're not going to be able to eat, right? Which is the whatchamacallit nerve, sciatic nerve, correct. I'm getting old. Okay, sciatic nerve. And in America, we don't eat that entire we don't eat that piece of meat. Here, I think in Israel, they know how to excise, some places know how to excise the sciatic nerve and the gid hanoshe, the sinew that surrounds it. Says the Sfarno, why don't we eat that? So most will say, out of kavod for Yaakov, to remember the event. Sfarno says, it's a fine, it's a knas. A fine, we're being fined for leaving Yaakov alone. They never should have left Yaakov alone. You know, if it was the John Wayne version, someone should have stood with him while he was going home, right? There shouldn't be a point where Yaakov is left alone. So that's the Sfarno. All right, but let's go on now. Yes?
But didn't Yaakov have the guarantee from Hashem that he would succeed and everything, and he would come back to Sholem? So why did he have to fear and
Because, very good question. Because number one, he is afraid that perhaps things have changed. In fact, the rabbis say that part of his fear is perhaps I've used up all my brownie points, right? Perhaps Kadosh Baruch Hu has done all the good he's going. That's number one. Number two, we're all promised all sorts of things, but we don't know the exact way they're going to turn out. How much pain might be involved in the eventual, right? But for example, we are all promised that Mashiach's going to come, right? This is something. So I've always, so you could wonder, couldn't you? You could say, God says Mashiach's going to come, so I'll sit back, right? I'm not going to work. I'm not going to do anything. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm waiting for Mashiach. I'll sit in the corner. You don't know when he's going to come. You don't know, will he come be ito? Will he come early? Will he come late? Will he come with pain? Chevle Mashiach. Will he come with great trouble? It all depends on us. So Yaakov says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised me I'd come back, but I don't know how much pain I'm going to have to go through before that happens. How many people am I going to have to lose? Who's going to... So all the promises of HaKadosh Baruch Hu are based upon how they occur, how they unfold, is based upon how we act. Otherwise, you know, we wouldn't have to act. We wouldn't have to struggle so much. All right, so that's the Pashupshat approach. What I told you is the John Wayne approach. There is a second approach. And there are, by the way, many variations within these approaches. Second approach is the Medrash. Famous Medrash. Yaakov forgot Pachim Ketanim. Right? It's famous Medrash that says that when Yaakov crossed over, he left behind some small little things and he went back to get them. And when he went back to get them, that's when he became vulnerable. Now, there is no indication in the text of that, so that, as I say, is Medrashic. It's a tradition that the rabbis postulate. What might be learned from that? So at first glance, I think it's problematic. You're fighting for your life. You're worried for your life. You're worried you're going to... Why endanger yourself for Pachim Ketanim, right? Why go back for something like that? So Shimshon Raphael Hirsch has something very, a very beautiful approach. Shimshon Raphael Hirsch says, that tzaddikim chavivim aleihem mamonam kegufam. That tzaddikim, their possessions are as dear to them as themselves. Now, what does that mean? Again, that's, you look at that and say, wait, conspicuous consumption, I don't like that. But what it means is the following. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu's given me something, then I shouldn't take it for granted. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu's given me something, it is something I should be grateful for. I should not treat it with disdain. I shouldn't say, oh my gosh, who cares? But it should be chaviv to me. It should be, and that is one way of looking at this. I don't want to rely on anyone else. I want to be able to protect what belongs to me. And I don't want to have to find myself in a position where others are going to have to support me or give to me. And therefore, what I'm going to do is I'm going to protect that which is mine. And therefore, that's possible. But the Medrash goes even further, and I think there's another possible message here. The Medrash elaborates on this event of Pachim Ketanim. The Medrash says that what happens is, and again, it's not in the text, this is just the rabbis teaching us lessons, perhaps. He stands on the other side of the river, and he looks back, and he sees this man there. He sees this stranger who's eventually going to struggle with him. And he sees that this stranger has a flock of sheep. And he says, maybe some of my sheep have gotten mixed up in his sheep. I'm going to go back and check. And that's when it becomes dangerous. So one way of viewing the Medrash, perhaps, is that Yaakov looks and says, maybe something that belongs to him could possibly be mine, meaning maybe there's something we share. Maybe I can find something in Esav's flock. Maybe it's not so bad. I'll go back and take a look. And it's when he thinks that maybe there's something in Esav's flock that might belong to him. Meaning what? Meaning there's some shared value of some kind. That's when the struggle ensues and Hashem says, understand, you can't find shared value in the flock of Esav. This is a separation here, and that's going to become clearer later.
Reminds me too much of World War II, where some people sent their kids out, and some people would just wanted to stay. They didn't want to give up what they had.
I was very all right. This is part of lessons we learn, right? Part of lessons we learn. We didn't. We don't. All right. Now let's go on. Vayimoser Yaakov levado, so we've got some understanding of how Yaakov is left alone. Vayeyoveg ish imo ad alos hashachar. Suddenly this being, right, appears, and this being is struggling with Yaakov until the break of dawn. So let's start with the definition or the identification of this ish. Who is this ish? Torah doesn't say it's a malach, right? Torah calls it an ish. So what's the classical interpretation? Classical interpretation is that it's Sar Tzivao Shel Esav. That it is the angel representing Esav's interests. Okay? It is the spiritual representation of Esav is struggling. Now, and the rabbis will see this prophetically. For example, the Ramban will say this is a prophetic vision of the struggle that we are going to have with the children of Esav. Ad alos hashachar. What's alos hashachar? Until dawn, until the days of Mashiach. And by the way, according to rabbinic thought, even though this is not biologically correct, who does Esav represent? What nation in the Gemara is seen as Edom?
Rome.
So the Ramban says this refers to the struggle with Rome. It refers to the struggle with that point of view, with that world. And we're going to struggle at Alos HaShachar, and we will be wounded. We will lose. In fact, the Ramban says that the wound is near the reproductive organs, where the exact hand went. which means that it's your children. You're going to lose children. You're going to lose souls across the war, across the years. It's prophetic. But let's go back to our original question. What's Yaakov doing in the middle of the night? Why is this angel wrestling with him? So now we see that there could be different interpretations. If Yaakov's trying to run away, what's the message of the angel? You can't run away. Right? If Yaakov's trying to run away, then the angel is there to stop him from running away. To basically say, you can't avoid this confrontation, you can't ignore it, right? You have to recognize it, you have to confront it, and you're going to be confronting it across history. Don't hide. You can't hide in the sand. You can't put your head in the sand. If Yaakov is not running away, and he was just rearranging the camp, the message is still the same, but it's not exactly the same. It's not that Yaakov was trying to avoid it, but that this is going to be an eternal confrontation. And in fact, it's best understood, and we'll see as this plays out, by recognizing the two dangers that confront Yaakov when he meets Esav. Two opposite dangers. What's one danger? It's obvious. He's going to kill him. What's the second danger? What? He's going to love him. Right? There, he's not going to kill him. That's the second danger, is he's not going to kill him. All right, and that what's going to happen is that Yaakov will see a harmonious meeting of souls here. So if that's the case, the purpose of the struggle with the angel is to tell Yaakov, don't misunderstand. When you meet Esav, don't be pulled in by any apparent desire for harmony, because on some level, there will always be a difference between you and him. There's always going to be something that you're going to have to recognize. There's always going to be a gap between you and him. All right, now, is there any other way to understand this struggle other than it being Sar Sevo Shel Esav? Is there another layer of potential interpretation?
Has anyone ever interpreted that potentially the entire struggle is Yaakov with himself? Am I doing the right thing? Is there a better way?
Yes. That's the answer to your question is yes. That's the second level of interpretation.
What's the question?
The second, I'll repeat it. The second level of interpretation here is that the struggle is an internal struggle. It is not Yaakov fighting with Esav. It is not Yaakov Again, when I say it's not, it is, but this is another layer of explanation. They could all be true, right? We've said all along, layers of explanation give you additional depth. It's Yaakov not just asking himself, am I doing the right thing now? But it's Yaakov fighting with his own demons. Esau's angry at me. Does he have a reason to be angry at me? Sure does, right? So I'm fighting with what I did. I'm now about to confront not just my brother, but I'm now about to confront a very turbulent past where I did some things that were questionable. And he's struggling with his own demons on the night before meeting Esav. So that's another layer of interpretation, which is very, very beautiful and equally possible. All right, so what happens? Struggles. He eventually is victorious, although he wins. And what does the angel say to him? Lo ye'omer od shimcha, lo Yaakov ye'omer od shimcha, ki im Yisrael, ki sorisa im Elokim ve'im anoshim vatucha. Your name will no longer be called Yaakov, but Yisrael, right? Because you will now, you have wrestled with man and with God, and you have succeeded. We're going to come back to that name change at the end of the class. Keep it in your mind. All right, so let's. So this is, we could talk about the struggle between Yaakov and this man and this angel or whatever it is, ad infinitum. There are many more interpretations, but I've tried to globally, you know, choose the various different options that stand before us. What happens next? Wakes up the next morning. Esav approaches. They see each other. And now look at the pasuk very carefully. Vayoratz Esav likraso, vayichabkehu, vayipol al tzavarov, vayishakehu, vayivku. Look at the Esav ran to meet him, embraced him, fell on his neck, kissed him, and they wept. Right, before we go into the pasuk itself, remember I told you in the very beginning that this is an ambivalent parsha, that this parsha is filled with event after event where the final result is unclear. Over the word vayishakehu in the Torah, you don't have it here, there is a phenomenon in the text. What is it? A series of dots over vayishakehu. What do those dots signify? So, of course, the rabbis argue. You have two opposite opinions. One opinion is that the dots are there to tell you that this was not sincere. That this was not sincere. That, in fact, that the Medrash will go on, and here the Medrash says that what happens, Yaakov, that he's not even trying to kiss him, that he's trying to bite him, and Yaakov's neck turns into stone. And what there? So these are, but what are the? What's the Medrash doing? It's elaborating. It's saying this is the enemy. There is a second approach that says no. That while it is true that there is enmity between these brothers, this was the one moment of sincerity. In this moment, Esav's emotions overcame him, and it was a moment of sincere love for his brother. Now, which one was it? Could be either. Could be both, right? So that's why these arguments are so telling, because you don't have the full result. You don't know. It could be either. It could be both. Story goes on. But take a look at the pasuk, and you do have a hint that something's going on here. What's interesting about the pasuk? Can you tell me anything? Okay, they wept. Right. What else?
We don't have the dots, but we can hear the similarity between Vayavak and Vayichabek.
Oh, interesting. Okay, the words, Vayavak and Vayichabek. Isaac is is an expert on language, and you see those two words have a certain similarity. Right, we don't have the dots here.
I find it strange that it says Esav ran to meet him. Yaakov didn't run to meet him.
Every single verb, until you got to they wept, is in the singular. Every one of those verbs, not just Esav running to meet him. Esav runs to meet him, embraces him, falls on his neck, kisses him, and they wept. Yaakov is passive. Esav is the only one who's doing this. Yaakov has been traumatized by that wrestling. He is... very unsure about this, right? So you don't see any reciprocity until they weep, and they could be weeping for different things, right? It's very possible that Esav is weeping for one thing and Yaakov's weeping for another. All right, so again, ambivalent, unclear, and why? Which of these is true? The answer is, throughout our history, it depends on the situation, right? I said the Torah is ambivalent. Should Yaakov have bowed down to Esav? So you have different points of view. You have some rabbis who say that's exactly the way you shouldn't deal with an Esav, right? You don't bow down to him. And you have rabbis like Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, who was friends with Antoninus, right? Who, when his servant wrote a letter to the Roman official Antoninus, who was Rabbi Yehuda's friend, and he wrote to the from the great, this is a servant writing a letter from the great Rebbe, Rebbe Yehuda, to Antoninus. He says, no. Say to the great Antoninus, right? Say, that's how you deal with it, because you see how Yaakov dealt with Esau. So, again, you see, sometimes diplomacy works, sometimes, and you're left ambivalent in the Torah to say, shades of gray, figure it out. Figure it out.
Is there a possibility by a Chabakeh who really refers to Yaakov, he saw Esau running to him, and then by a Chabakeh who Yaakov hugged Esau, and he pulled out some rope, and he fell on Esau's
I would not say that, because the language seems to indicate that it's all happening, you know, Vayisa Esav likraso vayichab keyu, and he hugged him. So it, no one seems to, it could be, but it seems to be an indication that it's all happening, because the first identification is with Esav. He did this, and they. That's what it seems to be in the text. Could be. Again, one of the things we said at the very beginning of the class is everything here is ambivalent. Okay, now, let's go to a fascinating coda to this pedigisha. Let's do the fascinating closing to this meeting, which nobody pays enough attention to. All right? They meet. They talk. Esau says to him, "Who were all these? What were all these things you sent me?" And Yaakov says, "My gifts for my brother." And Esau says, "I have a lot. I don't need it." And Esau says, "No." And Yaakov says, "No, take it." Then Esau tries to give Yaakov gifts, and Yaakov doesn't say, "I have a lot." Yaakov says, "Yesh li kol, I've got everything. I'm fine. I don't need anything from you." But look at what happens next. Vayomer. And apparently this is now Esav speaking. Nisa v'nelecha v'elcha l'negdecha. Okay, this has been a wonderful reunion, Esav says to his brother. Let's go, right? Nisa v'nelecha. Let's travel together, and I will travel negdecha. All right, now negdecha has a dual meaning. Okay, negdecha means with you or against you. All right. So, but okay, fine. Vayomer elav Adoni yoda. So Yaakov says to him, Esav, you know, ki hayilodim rakim v'hatzon v'abokor olos alai. You know that my children are weak, and that I got lots of cattle. And dfokum yom echad umesu kol hatzon. If I push too hard, please, you go. Yavor no Adoni lifnei avdo. You go ahead of me. Vanias naloli ti leregelam locha asher lefonai, and I'll go at my own speed. Ad asher avo el Adoni seira, until I get. Henry, and I catch up to you in your home of Seir. All right? So what does Esav say now? Vayomer Esav, atzigon no imcha min ha'am. All right, so let me give you some men to help you out. Right? Min ha'am asher iti. Vayomer, lama ze emsochein be'enei Adoni. Oh, please, don't do me any favors. But nicely, right? I'm sorry. You really don't have to do that. Vayoshav bayomahu Esav lidarko seira. Esav returns on his path to his home, Seir. V'Yaakov nosa sukosa. And Yaakov goes to Sukkot. Vayiven sham, vayiven lobayis, etc., and he builds a home. What is going on? So what's really happening here? This is one of those events that, had it turned out, it's one of those subtle events, unlike the angel wrestling with him, but this is even more important, because this is the result. What's Esav trying to do? Swallow him up, right? And Yaakov has to be very, very diplomatic. There are still 400 armed men standing and watching this, right? So he's got to negotiate. He's got to not... He doesn't want to travel with Esav. He doesn't want to get swallowed up. He doesn't want... He knows now, having gone through that struggle in the night before, that this is the result of that struggle, that he has to recognize the gap between himself and Esav, right? So he's negotiating a severance. He's negotiating to sever himself from his brother. And he does it, again, through deceit on some level. Because what does he say to his brother? He says to his brother, what? I'm going to catch up with you, and then he goes somewhere else entirely. But he feels that's the only way he can do this. And once again, Yaakov has to deceive someone, and once again, he'll be deceived in his lifetime. This is all part of that coda, that chorus that you hear again and again through Yaakov's life. But this small, this event, had this event ended differently, we wouldn't be here today. Right? Yaakov has to negotiate that severance, and if he doesn't succeed, then he's either overwhelmed by the army, or he is sucked into Esau's clutches. Now, it's fascinating to me, this is sort of an aside, that in the United States, and actually I don't know if it's in other countries as bad as it is in the U.S., we read Parshas Vayishlach always during what season of the year? The Christmas Hanukkah season, right? And Hanukkah is the holiday that speaks most clearly against assimilation, and it's the most assimilated holiday. Think about it, right? It's the most assimilated festival. And somehow there's real irony in that. And the need to struggle, to recognize. You know, it wasn't until I went to Rome the first time and stood outside the Colosseum and recognized what occurred in those walls that I realized what Chazal were saying, when it comes to Edom, when it comes to Rome, there's no meeting. You can admire what they've built. According to the Gemara, the rabbis admired, some of the rabbis admired their roads and their buildings and their power. But on a philosophical level, in terms of the value of human life, in terms of the value of the individual, in terms of the fact that we're created in the image of God, the gladiators, throw them to the lions or cherish each life. And that's why Chazal will say, at the time of the birth, or when Rivka, carrying the twins, goes to ask, why am I having so much trouble with this pregnancy? One of the lines she gets is, La'om mil'om ye'ematz. One of them will always be stronger. You're having twins, and the rabbis say, from here we learn the following. If someone tells you that Caesarea and Yerushalayim are both standing, don't believe him. Someone says to you, Caesarea and Yerushalayim are both destroyed, don't believe him. If someone says to you, God forbid Caesarea standing and Jerusalem is destroyed, or, please God, Yerushalayim is standing and Caesarea is destroyed, that you can believe. The two cannot coexist. And that's the struggle. That is fundamentally the struggle in the darkness of the night, to remind us of that. All right, now let's go to one last point, and then I've got a couple of announcements. First of all, I was asked to announce that roughly at 10:05 there's going to be a siren. Don't be afraid, it's a test. All right, so that's... Okay, turn to the next page for a second. What did the angel say to Yaakov? The angel said to Yaakov, your name is going to be Yisrael. Right? On the first paragraph, on the next page, later in the same parsha, Yaakov goes back to Bethel, and again God says to him, Lo Shimcha Yaakov, your name Yaakov, Lo Yikare Shimcha Yaakov Kim Yisrael. Their name will no longer be called Yaakov, so he changes it again. And that creates a riddle in the text. Because what changes twice in the Torah and doesn't seem to change at all? Yaakov's name. As soon after he is told you're going to be called Yisrael, what again does the Torah call him? Yaakov. And Yaakov and Yisrael are used interchangeably in the text. And this is unique. When it comes to name changes are meant to be permanent. So, for example, Avraham, we're told that once his name becomes Avraham, you are no longer supposed to be calling him Av. You're not supposed to call him Avram anymore. He is Avraham. Right? Sarai is no longer Sarai. She's Sarah. Why does Yaakov and Yisrael get this? So the rabbis understand the following. That these two names symbolize different places that Yaakov is in during his continued life, and even more so, different places his children will be across the face of history. There are times we will be Yaakov, and there are times we will be Yisrael, and only when Alos HaShachar comes will we finally fully be Yisrael. And Yaakov symbolizes struggle, Yisrael symbolizes triumphant, victory, triumph, and those are the experiences that we're going to jockey, that Yaakov jockeys between, and we will jockey between. And I chose one particular section of the Torah where the use of these names is clearest in my mind, because it's fascinating. Take a look at what happens. Take a look at the last section here. We're talking now about when Yaakov Avinu travels back to Egypt, or travels to Egypt, right? What's happening? The brothers come to tell him that Yosef is still alive. Vayalu Mitzrayim vayavo Eretz Kanan el Yaakov avihim. They come to their father Yaakov, because he's Yaakov. He's mourning for Yosef. He's very depressed. He's been depressed since Yosef has left. They talk to him. He refuses to believe it. Understandably, right? Who would believe that Yosef is still alive? And who would believe that Yosef still alive is second in command in Egypt? But they talk to him, they show him the Agalos. Eventually we'll talk about this. Vatechi Ruach Yaakov Avihem. And the spirit of Yaakov, their father, began to live. Look in the next pasuk. Vayomer Yisrael. No longer is he Yaakov, he is now Yisrael. Vayisa Yisrael. He's going now. He's going to go back to see Yosef. This is wonderful. This is great. He's not Yaakov anymore. He's Yisrael. Vayomer, and this is fascinating. Vayomer Elokim liYisrael, Maros Halayla. God appears to him in Maros Halayla, in the darkness of the night. Vayomer Yaakov, Yaakov. Says to him, Yaakov, Yaakov. Don't be afraid of going to Mitzrayim. I'm going to go down with you. I'll take you out. And Yosef is going to put his hands on your eyes. You're going to die there. So what's going on here? Why does God say don't be afraid? Yisrael was not being afraid. He was skipping down the path. So I'll tell you how I interpret this. What is God saying to Yaakov? Yaakov, you should be afraid. Let's understand what's happening here. You're not just going back to see Yosef. You personally will never get out of Egypt. And what is this going to usher in? A tough time. You're leaving the land of Israel. You're leaving Eretz Yisrael. Your children are going into Golus. Yaakov, Yaakov. Don't be Israel. Be afraid. Recognize that level of this experience. And now that I've told you that you have to be afraid, don't be afraid, because it'll work out. Look at the last pasuk. Vayakom Yaakov Bibeer Sheva. He's not Israel now after that dream. He's returned to being Yaakov. Vayisu b'nei Yisrael is Yaakov avihem. And now what has to happen? His children have to carry him. His children have to put him into the Agola and carry him down to Egypt, because he's no longer skipping down the path. And you see how that play, the interplay of the words, Yaakov and Yisrael, and those psukim work so perfectly. And that's an example of how we're meant to see the use of those names from that point on. It's probably the best example it's the best one I can find. I think it's probably the best example there is. So anyway, once again, ambivalence. We're not there yet, right? Who are we? We're Yaakov and Yisrael, and that is the grays of Parshas Vayishlach carry to the future. Okay, that's just a test, everybody. Don't worry.